All right, let's get this thing started, shall we? The first presentation is by Ben Dawson, who is a senior engineer and former managing partner at Hatfield & Dawson Consulting Engineers in Seattle. He is a registered professional electrical engineer in Washington State and California. He's a senior member of the IEEE, a member of the Association of Federal Communications Consulting Engineers, and the Society of American Military Engineers. Ben has published numerous papers, many on medium wave antenna engineering matters, and has designed and implemented dozens of new and rebuilt medium wave antennas at power levels as high as 2 megawatts. Ben Dawson.
I hope you already are ready for a bit of technical material and a bit of history this early in the morning. It's pretty early for me, of course, because I'm a West Coast guy, but nonetheless, the breakfast was lovely, and the coffee has done its job, and I think I'm awake. A little bit of history, I think, is a kind of a useful thing these days, because a remarkable percentage of the technical personnel in the broadcast industry are a lot younger than some of us and didn't grow up with vacuum tubes and phono oscillators in the garage or the basement and don't know about things like complicated directional antennas. So I'll start out by talking a little bit about the history, but I've got three basic things to cover this morning. What kind of cost-effective changes are possible for the AM transmission plant? What the Commission's ongoing AM revitalization rulemaking is all about, and to be very specific on a technical subject, what antenna characteristics are really appropriate for the use of the new moment method antenna proof rules, which have made very effective, cost-effective changes in the way that we enable and maintain AM directional antennas, a task that took us a long time to get the Commission to agree to. All right. There we go. AM history in a nutshell. Well, the first broadcasting service was the AM broadcasting facilities that were constructed in the 1920s, and through the 1930s, the technical standards got developed. And about 1930, 38, 39, I see I didn't know the date when I made this slide up. About 1937, 38, 39 were the negotiations that led to the North American Broadcast Agreement, which set the basic technical standards for allocation in the AM band. And directional antennas were developed at just about this time as well, the late 1930s. Right after World War II, there was a huge explosion of AM facilities in the United States because there was the pent-up period of the war when there was no new construction really permitted because of the availability of materials and the devotion of the country's resources to winning the war. But that explosion created an awful lot of stations that are probably increasingly marginal in some way or another, either technically marginal because they haven't been maintained, or in some cases marginal from a business standpoint because the industry's changed so much, particularly after the market acceptance of FM broadcasting. Now, I'm old enough to have worked at an FM station in the days when they were marginal and barely surviving, so the change in the acceptance of FM broadcasting is a huge thing that's occurred during my professional lifetime, and it's pretty remarkable. But the same kind of changes keep going on in the electronic communications and the electronic media industry, and we're seeing those, you know, go on every day as we keep working. Many AM stations are still pretty valuable, though. There are a variety of circumstances under which AM stations maintain their value. They can serve specialized audiences. They may serve markets that are isolated in such a way that the big city down the road is very far down the road and therefore doesn't cover a smaller market. And there are a variety of other circumstances where specialized programming, you know, can make an AM station very valuable. Sometimes as an adjunct to a, a broadcaster who also has FM transmitting facilities as well. And of course, nowadays, we've got the ability to add translators in the FM band to AM station operation as a result of changes commissions made fairly recently in the translator rules. It's interesting to know, however, that FM translators of AM stations have been around a long time, and hardly anyone ever knew that because they were all in Alaska. There we go. What's the technical basis for AM? Like I said, a lot of engineers in the industry are young enough to have not really ever had to study this problem, so I thought I'd give you a little once-over view here. The daytime AM service is by ground wave, the propagation of the electric magnetic fields along the surface of the Earth, the boundary between the Earth and the atmosphere. And the nighttime service, which is significantly different, of course, and has significantly different interference effects, comes about because of ionospheric reflection caused by the band of ionized particles in the upper atmosphere. And those electric and magnetic fields that get propagated from an AM station are created by the transmission system. And the reason it looks the way it does is because Maxwell showed the relationship between electric and magnetic fields in his famous equations. And a British engineer named, or physicist named Pocklington, showed the real mathematics for determining exactly how antennas work, showing that the speed of light in steel is slower than it is in free space, and also that the current distribution in an antenna isn't quite, but is approximately sinusoidal. So for lots of purposes, the simple sinusoidal mathematics is acceptable, but for very, very precise purposes, it's not. And then an American engineer, Stuart Ballantyne, wrote a paper pointing out that the vertical antenna over a ground plane was the most cost-effective and efficient and practical antenna for AM broadcasting. And so that's when we started seeing tower antennas back there in the late 1930s, rather than the rooftop, highly top-loaded wire antennas, T antennas and L antennas that we used to see in big cities sometimes, and most all of which I think have now gone away. Directional antennas, which were developed also in the late 1930s, allowed a lot more stations to be, operate without creating interference. I think it's kind of interesting that the very first one in St. Petersburg or Clearwater, Florida, was designed to protect a Wisconsin station, WTMJ. And there were a lot of theories about why a station in Florida was interfering with a station in Wisconsin. I mean, people thought, well, it's flowing up the Mississippi River, or a lot of other esoteric foolishness. But a couple of great engineers whose names, one of whom was later an FCC commissioner, created the first directional antenna and figured out how to make it work. And right after World War II, just a few years later, there was that huge explosion of AM stations, and that caused directional antennas to be very common. And not only that, it allowed for a lot more stations. Now, as a result of that explosion of services, and as a result of the restrictions in radiation one direction or another is by use of directional antennas, a lot of markets have grown a lot larger, I should say, than the coverage area of a significant number of the AM stations. Sure, the 50 kilowatt clear channel guys can still cover big cities just fine in most cases, but lots of 5 and 10 and 50 kilowatt stations with complex directional antennas discover that the market's grown in the areas where they don't radiate any signal. And a lot of cities also now have very, very built up downtown areas. My city of residence, Seattle, used to have the tallest building in the West, the Smith Tower, and there are now at least 25 other buildings in downtown Seattle taller than the Smith Tower. And as a consequence, those attenuation effects really affect the signal in the downtown area of big cities, so that even 25 millivolts of signal sometimes isn't enough to overcome the noise from all of the electrical devices that everybody uses nowadays. The ubiquitous wallwort is an enormous source of interference all over the radio frequency spectrum, and the proliferation of lots of other devices, computer-controlled toasters, has really created a lot of noise problems, and it's particularly egregious for AM because the natural noise levels are higher, lower in frequency than, for example, the VHF band. So part one of the talk here, now that I've gone through that rambling introduction, is how do you make cost-effective changes in AM stations? And there are a variety of things that you might be able to do to make cost-effective changes. You can increase the power, you can change the antenna system, you can move the site if its city has grown completely around you. You can reduce or cease operation in order to allow the real estate to be used for something else. You can sometimes allow the real estate to be used for something else and maintain the operation of an AM station. And there are some good examples of that. Probably the best known is the one in Los Angeles where the radio stations at Towers Industrial Park, the radio station antenna system was in a nice location, developable for a industrial complex, and that complex was built around the radio towers. There's a good paper on that subject that's in the NAB proceedings about 20 years ago that Ron Rackley and the late Augie Prestel wrote. And there are a lot of other examples as well. One that I'm familiar with is in Reno, in Las Vegas, where there's a residential development that is built on an AM transmitter site. We got to design the shielding that all of the houses were built with. They were stucco houses, and so we used the chicken wire for shielding. So there are a variety of things that you can do to increase the value of your AM station or to extract value from the real estate that it owns. Now, are any of these possible for your station? Well, you need to investigate. Can you increase power? Surprisingly, quite a number of stations find that they can increase power modestly because the commission about 15 years ago changed the rules to allow power levels that weren't a set of discrete values. No longer were you restricted to 250, 500, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, 1 or 2 25,000s, and 50,000 watts. Now you can operate with, 1,700 watts or 5,900 watts. So that's something that can be investigated. If you're not in a major market, it's probably more likely that you can do this than if you're in one of the major markets. But nonetheless, there are plenty of stations that find that they can make modest power increase changes. And you can make that determination using the software that a couple of vendors provide, or you can have someone who does this more frequently or even for a living, like a consulting engineer, do it for you and make a determination of exactly what kind of power increase might be possible. The only limitation really is the roundoff rule in the commission's rules about discrete power levels. About 1 dB is about the minimum usable increase in power, but even 1 dB can be helpful. Now, can you change the antenna system in some way? Well, it's pretty much the same considerations as a power increase. You determine the allocation conditions, and then you look at your antenna and see what kind of changes might be possible. One that frequently occurs is if you've got a tower that's about to fall over because the owner, two owners ago, never spent any money at all on maintaining it, and you need to replace it, you need to consider the possibility that a taller tower or a tower of different height might allow you to get some more coverage or some increased power or at least some increased field strength. And if you've got a directional antenna already, then perhaps a change in parameters may be valuable. This can be kind of tough in some places because of the adjacent channel rule having been changed from 0 dB to 6 dB a few years ago, and I'll talk about that in a minute when I talk about the AM revitalization rules. Can you change transmitter site? Well, we all know that the price of real estate makes implementing a new transmitter site for an AM station pretty tough. But if the present real estate's worth a lot of money, I mean, I've looked at two sites now where there was a consideration of a shopping center or a Walmart, and specifically a Walmart, in fact, being built either on or directly adjacent to an AM transmitter site on property the AM station owned. Sometimes a new site can be very expensive to develop. We have to go through a lot of hoops these days in order to build any kind of a tower. The cellular folks have really made that tough by their sometimes inappropriate behavior. But if you go through the process and look at the local land use rules and look at the environmental rules and look at the FAA's airspace considerations, which, you know, all of which are not difficult to do. The answers may not be pleasant, but sometimes you can be surprised. You can sometimes simplify a station's operation as well by selling a site and moving it and downgrading it to a daytime-only station. Since you've got an FM translator anyway, even if you're carrying those high school football games that are absolutely valuable, one old friend and client told me the other day that 75% of his station's revenue comes from local sports. And I don't think he's an anomaly. I think there are a lot of small market stations that are in that situation. Now, another very, very interesting situation these days is the possibility of consolidating. And in part, this has come about because we now have the ability to own multiple AM stations in a single market, but we also can sometimes make arrangements with our friends and competitors who own another station in the market. And diplex and even tri and quadruplex stations have now become pretty common, where once they were really quite unusual. There were only maybe as few as half a dozen back in the 1950s, but now there are a great many of them. I just finished working on one in Kansas City a couple of weeks ago. It requires a suitable host antenna, and so it needs to be investigated to determine if the neighbors in your market have an antenna that's suitable for this, you know, before you even investigate what kind of a deal you might be able to make with the guy who owns the antenna system. I've got an old friend from college days who owns a major market station in California, and his real estate is worth way more than his AM station is. And he told me at lunch a while back that AM station has had negative cash flow for at least the last 10 or 15 years. And he'd really like to get off the site. And the only problem is the only other facility in town with an antenna system that would meet his requirements is owned by somebody who won't deal with the possibility of a second station on the site for reasons that no one can figure out. It isn't even a competitive situation because the host station in that situation, you know, is a foreign language station, and my friend's station is an English language station. They don't even compete. But it's worth investigating. And the other thing that you have to keep in mind is that low-frequency stations are harder to move in this fashion than stations in the upper part of the band because of the fact that the tower heights are electrically short at the lower frequencies. And I mistyped this because a quarter-wave tower at 1,500 kilohertz is only about a sixth wavelength tall at 1,000 kilohertz and about a tenth wavelength tall at 550. Diplexing two stations closer than 50 kilohertz is impractical. We do have a situation we worked on some years ago where we've got three stations triplexed into an antenna, and two of them are 50 kilohertz apart, and it was an interesting effort to get that to work. 80 kilohertz spacing is sometimes practical, but the filtering can be tough, particularly at higher power levels, because if you're just used to the kind of filters that we use in VHF and UHF transmission, those nice big cans that are sit in the corner and don't get very warm. At medium frequencies, the problem is we use discrete component filters, and the circulating current in those filters can be very high. So if you've got, we're in the process of studying a diplexing situation where we've got a 2.5 kilowatt station and a 50 kilowatt station that are going to be diplexed into a common antenna. And it's a situation where there are a lot of parts available from a dismantled directional antenna. And so I went through the design process and looked at all the parts. And then I said, well, we need some more. We need at least 3 vacuum variable capacitors capable of 30 kV. And a couple of fixed ones, and a 100-amp coil. And the total cost of all that stuff was about $18,000, and the client just about choked on that, not having realized that the filtering to get a 50-kilowatt station properly filtered, even for, in this case, 200 kilohertz spacing, those circulating currents, drives the cost up. But still, that's far less than the cost of developing a new transmitter site, even for an omnidirectional antenna, which this happens to be. So the cost of diplexing a directional antenna can sometimes be comparable to building a new site from scratch, but sometimes it isn't. And the problem you have to do is to do a careful investigation to see just what's practical and cost effective. Is your site really valuable? Maybe just turning in the license and selling the real estate's the most effective thing to do. If you're an old guy like me and you grew up with AM and, you remember those Western Electric Dohertys and those RCA 250-watt BTA 250Ls and all those lovely old pieces of hardware, it's real hard to think about just giving up the license. But if it's not making money, and it's not going to make money, and the real estate's getting more and more valuable, not to mention the taxes on the real estate getting higher and higher every year, maybe the best thing to do is just simply grit your teeth and give it up. And if you look at the commission's releases, you see people doing this, not at all infrequently. If the station doesn't really benefit from nighttime operation, maybe the best thing to do is knock down all 5 of those towers and or all 5 of those 6 towers and just keep one of them and run non-directional daytime and run your FM translator for the nighttime operation. And if you don't benefit from the nighttime operation at all because you don't do high school football or whatever else happens at night, and we don't do rock and roll remotes from drive-in restaurants anymore, at least I haven't heard one in a long time. They were a feature of my childhood for sure. Maybe that's the thing to do. Maybe it's to sell off all the real estate that you don't actually need for a much more simple operation. And there are some people who are selling off their real estate to real estate operations that are putting putting other facilities on AM transmitter sites. Vertical Bridge is the one that is probably the most well-known. Having bought a whole bunch of sites from iHeart, and Vertical Bridge is now developing those sites for other uses, and in ways that are compatible with the continued operation of the AM stations. Is the existing coverage more than the actual core market? Now this does happen sometimes, and if your core market is pretty small and your coverage is pretty large, maybe you should just reduce power and keep the electric bill lower. Another thing you can do, of course, without really damaging your coverage, is to operate with modulation-determined carrier level, which is very effective and very practical, and quite a lot of people do that, and there have been some significant power savings as a result of that. The second item is the AM revitalization rule. What's it mean? Well, it's kind of a grab bag. There are a bunch of changes. The land rush for FM translators has already happened, and the community coverage and similar rules the commission's already modified, and they got rid of the ratchet rule, thankfully, and they now allow modulation determined carrier operation. But the rules they haven't decided on yet are the basic allocation rules, changing the nighttime protection for those 50 kilowatt guys, Class A guys, changing the nighttime interference calculation method to get rid of the adjacent channels, Changing the daytime protection so that it's the 1 millivolt rather than the half millivolt contour, and maybe requiring surrender of those expanded band licenses or the ones that they were paired with, of which there are a bunch left. The protection requirement for Class B, C, and D stations is interesting. Class D stations are daytime-only stations. Class C stations are the ones that are the former Class 4s, the local channel stations, 1230, 1240, 1340, 1400, 1450, and 1490. And when the commission adopted the 1 kilowatt power rule for those stations, they didn't say it in the rulemaking, and it doesn't say it in the rules. But what that actually is it just simply changed the protected contour for those stations to the 1 millivolt contour instead of the half millivolt contour. Because a 6 dB power increase, I'm sorry, yes, a 6 dB power increase is the same as a 2-to-1 signal strength increase. And there's even another case where the commission already used the 1 millivolt contour as the protected contour. The rule was changed when Docket 87-267 was adopted about 18 years ago. And that is that for a long, long time, a station that was the only station licensed to its community under a certain set of conditions could accept interference up to its 1 mil contour. So the commission made that determination a long time ago, and they even, staff put out a report on this subject in about 1987, but when the Docket 87-267 changes occurred, they got ignored. And the reason they got ignored is because people were worried about wideband transmission. Well, they thought that somehow receivers were going to be available with wideband operation, and that's never happened. The basic bandwidth of almost all AM receivers is less than 5 kilohertz. So the consequence is that the rules that the commission's proposed change the circumstances to be a better fit with reality and not some kind of utopia. Nighttime protection involves the root sum square, and the adjacent channel stations have to be taken into account, first adjacent channel, and they're proposing to change that and also go back to the 50% RSS interference rule that was formerly the case. We don't know what's going to happen with those, and we don't know what's going to happen with the daytime protection either. There are a lot of arguments one way or the other, and there was some pretty specious filings by some people, whom I won't name. But as a consequence, you know, it's pretty likely that the commission sometime soon, in my lifetime I hope, will adopt some basic changes in the allocation rules. And there are a couple other things, the requiring people that have expanded band stations to give up one or the other. And it was supposed to be temporary, but it hasn't been. The commission is very, very likely to adopt a change to eliminate the main studio rule pretty soon, which is a real benefit for a lot of people, especially people with multiple stations in nearby markets. Now, my final point here is about the moment method proof rules and about when a moment method proof is really a suitable thing to do. It took 17 years for the commission to finally adopt the process to allow us to use the much more scientific methods of the moment method proof rules than the traditional field strength measurement rules. I filed a comments in that proceeding, and I included a one-page list of all the reasons why magnetic field measurements were inappropriate for determining the operation of antennas in complex environments. And the surface of the Earth is a complex environment, even out in the middle of Iowa, and certainly in any city of any size. And there's plenty of science to point that fact out very, 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 very well. But there are circumstances in which a moment method proof, despite all of its simplicity and cost savings over the years, is not the appropriate thing to do. The rule for a moment method proof is that towers 120 degrees or shorter or 190 degrees and taller can be monitored at the base using current transformers. And towers that are taller than just a little over a quarter wavelength can use base voltage samples as well. Base voltage samples aren't real common, but they're sure effective in a lot of circumstances. And any system can be monitored with sample loops at about one-third of the tower height if the cross-section of the towers are identical. That's an interesting problem because a lot of arrays got built over time, and the station went on the air and put up a tower, and then they added directional antenna for nighttime operation and put up two more towers, and then some truck driver ran into a guy wire and knocked one of them down, and so they put up another tower, and all three of the towers are different, even though if you get 50 feet away from them, they look exactly the same. Here's an example. This is the 1090 array in Seattle, and it's got identical leg and crossmember sizes, in fact, but the pattern of those crossmembers is different. And so sample loops couldn't be used on this array. When we did a moment method proof, we used base voltage samples. Lots and lots of systems meet the criteria for a moment method proof, but you need to be aware of the circumstances under which a moment method proof would not be a good idea. So there are a couple of different situations and a third consideration with respect to this. Any pattern that has a lot of augmentations normally got those augmentations as a result of successive partial proofs in which the nulls got let out and it was clear that there wasn't anybody who was going to be interfered with because the original nulls were done in 1948 and the circumstances were different in 1958 and 1968. And so you ended up with a pattern that has a lot of augmentations. Anytime your pattern has significant augmentations, you should always look carefully at the circumstances before a moment method proof is done. We've seen a couple of cases where stations had very substantial, significant coverage in the minimum region of their array because the nulls had been let out over time from partial proofs because the engineers could show the commission that interference wouldn't be created because the original minima or nulls were just tighter than they needed to be. Those guys who did the analysis back in 1948 or 1958 with slide rules, that's how I learned to do it, they tried to use as much simplification in the math as they possibly could, and sometimes that meant they didn't, you know, they made things a lot tighter than they needed to. And they used careful analysis of the field strength measurements to show that they were meeting those deep nulls. And later on, somebody figured out they weren't really necessary and let them out. But rather than file a new theoretical pattern, they just simply augmented the existing pattern because it's a simpler process. You don't have to go through a 301. You can do it with a 302. And particularly if you needed to do it in less than a couple of years, it was a lot easier to do it with augmentations. And there are several reasons why a pattern can have augmentations. It may have had its proof of performance done before the standard pattern rule came along. The augmentations may have been added because it resulted in better coverage. Or it may have been because there were changes in the allocation circumstances. So look very carefully at the augmentations. Another situation is a pattern may have operating parameters that are quite different than the theoretical parameters. And you see this in a surprising number of cases. Because particularly simple arrays, three-tower inline arrays and two-tower cardioid-type arrays can have the same pattern from significantly different actual operating conditions than the theoretical pattern does. And so you have to be real careful about this because changing to the standard pattern means you have to adjust things to the theoretical pattern. And that can cause a lot of difference. Here's an example. In this case, the augmentations are more than 2-to-1 in some directions. And the use of a moment method proof would result in radiation in those minor lobes to the theoretical values far lower than the actual adjusted values. And you don't want to do that. Another example is, this is a Class A station. This happened before the ratchet rule got revoked and was one of the good arguments against the ratchet rule. We filed an application for a Class A station to fill its nulls and to cover suburban areas that weren't there when the station was put on the air in 1947. And somebody had filed a completely bogus application in the year 2000 filing window. And it was in the major lobe, the first adjacent channel to this station. And the commission wouldn't let us change our theoretical pattern, even though we were reducing the field toward that other guy because of the ratchet rule. Fortunately, they got rid of the ratchet rule, but it gives you a good example of why you need to carefully look at the significant augmentations in a pattern. We quickly abandoned the idea after we showed that we'd lose a lot of area and population with a moment method proof, even though the State Highway Department would have paid for the moment method proof, because the reason we studied this to begin with was because they were building a new highway overpass right next to the transmitter site, right in the major lobe. And so we got hired by the Highway Department to investigate it, and the station happened to be a station we did work for occasionally anyway. And so even though it wouldn't have cost the station anything, we left them with a traditional proof of performance in their augmentations and added some augmentations that we determined we could do. Another one is the situation where the patterns aren't adjusted to the theoretical parameters. And historically, some stations have amazingly intentionally misadjusted patterns that don't fit the theoretical. And the situation normally comes about because of stuff that happened back in the 40s and 50s before the standard pattern rule came into account. And sometimes you could get desired coverage by intentional misadjustment, and augmentations, or before the standard pattern rule, just simply maximum expected operating values, or MEOVs, which you created on the pattern with a set of French curves and not with mathematics. And sometimes these got converted nicely when the commission converted everybody to a standard pattern, and they can still cause you real interesting problems. And some patterns can be created with more than one set of parameters. Setting them to the license pattern would require such a significant change that the whole phasing system would have to be rebuilt. And that's just almost never cost effective, unless the original one's already falling apart and you need to replace it anyway. Here's an example. This station's licensed facility versus its operating facility, you can see the significant difference there in the middle purple line, what they're actually doing versus what the licensed theoretical pattern should provide for in that minimum. In this particular case, using the theoretical pattern would have cost a lot of money in order to rebuild the whole system. And so after all the repairs, we just did a conventional proof on this station. There's one other example I didn't show, but it's shown in the written paper. I left some copies of the written paper I did a year or two ago at the NAB convention on this subject over on the table on the far wall, along with a document about depreciation and deferred maintenance, which you may find useful to show to whoever the bean counter is in your organization. It's just a one-page paper, but I talk about how the railroads and the electric utilities deal with deferred maintenance. I mean, deferred maintenance is a perfectly good thing to do if you know that the facility has got a termination time. If you know that 5 years from now, your lease is up, there's no practical way for you to ever find a new transmitter site, so you know this thing's going to go off the air, then don't spend any more money on it than is necessary to keep it operating so that it's whatever cash flow it's generating is still okay. So you might find that paper useful to deal with certain kinds of management who don't understand the mathematics of deferred maintenance and depreciation. And the final examples I'm giving in this talk here are basically economic ones. If you've got a well-maintained, simple directional antenna, and it doesn't drift, and it doesn't give you any problems with the monitor points, or even if you have to change a monitor point occasionally because somebody builds a service station on top of your monitor point, leave it alone. The biennial certification costs for moment method proof, although the commission's changing the rules for that and has made it simpler, nonetheless, they're real costs, and you need to keep those into account. And it may well be that your simple array, where all you have to do is go out once a year and make sure the monitor points are okay, and where you don't have your the tank network and your 1949 design phaser doesn't require you to buy new coil clips at least every 3 or 4 years because the old ones burn up. You know, if you have a good, stable system that's dependable and reliable, then you probably should just leave it as is. Well-constructed systems are generally capable of operation for a long period of time. People say, well, you know, vacuum capacitors wear out. Well, in shortwave transmitters, where they have to be changed 4 times a day, sure, they wear out. In an AM antenna system where they get set and maybe readjusted every 10 years, they don't wear out. If you check the monitor points and, you know, spend a day out of the office on a nice day and turn off your cell phone while you're making the monitor point measurements, why, there's just simply no reason at all not to keep an existing AM antenna, directional antenna system in operation under the old rules. We engineers really like moment method proofs, and even if we're going to do a conventional proof on an array because the physical circumstances don't meet the moment method rules, we'll still use moment method techniques to generate the new system design or redesign, and we'll use whole system modeling, you know, to evaluate the phaser and evaluate all of the parts and pieces, even if we don't use a moment method proof. So it's a really valuable tool. Interestingly enough, most people don't know that the moment method techniques that we use were developed by the American Navy, a source of a lot of fine telecommunications work over the years, to deal with their low-frequency antennas. And so we're very grateful for our friends at the Navy for having done that. And one final economic example is that if you've got old sample lines of an obsolete type and you can't find that type of line anymore, you may have to, if they're unequal length particularly, you may have to replace them in order to use a moment method proof, and that can be cost prohibitive as well. A lot of old transmission lines, we've even run into 65-ohm Western Electric line at a still operating AM directional antenna that works just fine, and we left it alone. Moment method techniques are very, very valuable, but just use them when they're appropriate. So, I got 2.5 minutes left if anyone has a question. Somebody needs to turn your mic on so I can hear you.
I'm on now. Okay.
There we go.
One thing nobody ever mentions, I have an old or relatively new GE Super Radio, a couple of old Sony transistors, an old Radio Shack tabletop. The AM comes in fantastic. Hardly any interference at all. My brother's got an old 65 Ford Fairlane. The AM radio sounds great. Why aren't they talking about making it mandatory to put in decent chips from the manufacturer? That's the cheap solution.
Well, the FCC has almost no control over the marketplace for receivers. The only exception to that rule was when they mandated UHF television coverage and analog television receivers. The fact of the matter is, we have a GE Super Radio in our office, and its bandwidth is only about 5.5 kilohertz. It just simply does have a real 5.5 kilohertz bandwidth. Most AM radios don't even have that. You're lucky if they're 3.5. So your good-sounding radio, and I have a Sony portable that I use that's got shortwave on it that I take when I travel outside the U.S. Same thing. I mean, the bandwidth on it is very good. It's about 4.5 kilohertz. in the AM band. And as a consequence, the AM on it sounds better than FM does, but it's still limited bandwidth. And that limited bandwidth is very valuable because it keeps all that stuff that's out there, 8 and 10 and even 15 kilohertz, out of the situation. When I was a corporate director of engineering, I worked for a station that had a Continental Doherty transmitter and solid-state audio gear when that wasn't common, and we could pass an FM proof with that AM station, no problem, out to 15 kilohertz. But nobody had a receiver that would get it. And the idea that wideband receivers will someday become available is, I'm afraid, pie in the sky, because there's no reason for the manufacturers to do that. Yes?
I understand the recertification of the moment of method proofing of a sample system has been eliminated.
Yes.
Unless you'd make repairs to the system.
Yes, essentially that's true. Just very, very recently.
I need a clarification. Are you saying that with existing method of moment installations, that it's still a good idea to occasionally do monitor points on the system, to check monitor points of every few months, just to make sure that...
I was talking about arrays that have conventional proofs, not arrays with moment method proofs.
Okay.
As long as the sample system doesn't exhibit any problems or irregularities, and you're well within your licensed parameters, and there are no other indications of problems, there's no reason to make field strength measurements associated with a moment method proofed array. You do occasionally find people who are running their daytime power nighttime, and you can check that, but that's a different kind of problem. Yes, sir?
Quick question with the mom proof rules coming up. If you want to change or add like an STL dish to your antenna, you're still looking at having to have the system reproofed or rechecked?
You need to look at the new rule carefully because it defines that.
Okay.
And under some circumstances, you don't.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all.